This is episode 374, dated Friday, August 23rd, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. This is episode 374, dated Friday, August 23rd, 2024, one day before my fifth wedding anniversary. Amy and I were married 5 years ago tomorrow, and we're still going strong. Thank God for that. Before we continue, let me introduce our friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how are you today?
Doing fine. It's sort of a dreary, rainy day here in Coos Bay, but we're doing fine. Congratulations on your five-year anniversary. That's awesome.
Thank you very much, Peter. And our weather has been autumn-like for about 2 or 3 days. We're going to be moderating back to summer-type weather over the weekend and into early next week. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Our media sources, thank you for what you do. Thank you for airing us when you can. We appreciate that very much. Also, Jacqueline Sylvia, our web designer. Thank you for archiving our programs on my website. To get there, just go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them. And you will see most of our archived programs, from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
We have a return guest on our program. He's been on before, Jonathan Gale. He's a disability policy specialist, and he's coming back on the show to talk about some very important topics in regards to employment of persons with disabilities. Jonathan, as always, it's a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about accommodations and other employment-related stuff, can you give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of your background and how you got into the advocacy work?
Sure, absolutely. I am 69 years young. I am totally blind, and I have been for 36 years, been legally blind all my life. I got into advocacy work, first of all, kind of by accident, really. My oldest son, who is now 48, is developmentally disabled. And as a result of that, when he was a small child, I got involved in Massachusetts. They were called 766 regulations and 504 regulations for kids with special needs and mainstreaming. So that got me into doing advocacy work around educational components for kids, teens, and then for people who were hitting that 22 age bracket, if you will, and basically transforming from school programs and transitioning into group home programs, things like that. During that period of time, I had a separate career. I was actually with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Department of Revenue teaching tax law as a tax examiner. And I decided to take a full-time early retirement in my early 50s because I wanted to do what I really had a passion for, and that was working on disability policy law and a lot of teaching and a lot of training and related to those areas, because I felt that there were so many areas of disability policy law and procedure that were untouched and that mainstream didn't know about. By mainstream, I mean hospitals, medical facilities, trauma one centers, a lot of large corporations for department stores that many of us go to, things like that as well. So I transformed myself, if you will. Jokingly said I had to keep my wife working for a while so I could go out and play, but playing paid off. And for the past 18 years now, I have been a full-time disabilities advocate. I have two parts to what I do. One of the components is teaching reasonable accommodations and disclosure to corporations and medical facilities, as I noted. And the other part is working with private clients through my team to help them help support the needs they need, because very often there are, when a person has a disability or is identified as having a disability, in most cases, families don't know where to turn, what to do, how to do it, how to speak the language, what's necessary, how to advocate or in some cases demand services and so forth. So they contract out to a consultant like myself through J. Gale Consulting. So
in the past 18 years, Jonathan, since you started your full-time work as an advocate, how much of an impact do you think this has had on the resources that you just said were not aware of such policy. Do you think it's made a tremendous impact positively?
The answer is yes and no. To the individual families that I've worked with, which have been in the hundreds, it's absolutely made an impact. It's changed not only the lives of the person with disability, but the understanding of the disability through the family members, through extended friends, through agencies and programs that these individuals are going to be involved with in many cases for the rest of their life. For a lot of the organizations, it's not so simple because, you know, you can go and you can do a training to 150 people in a management, you know, of a management team for a large company. And 5 years later, there's only 20% of them left.
Yeah.
You can do the same thing at a medical facility in a trauma one center. And 5 years later, there's only 20-30% of them left. So when you look at the sector where you're trying to actually teach individuals who are going to interact with people with varying disabilities, you hope that they take the skills that you're teaching them and that you're discussing with them wherever they go. But it's really hard to know sometimes. There's no real measurement tool that I found yet that uses anything like that. The only tool I found is that I've gone to other places at times and run into some of the same people who will say, I remember you from 10 years ago, and I still use that practice today. So, you know, I guess that's the best answer I can give you.
Well, to keep this whole concept alive, I think we would all hope that the people that you're teaching will do their own teaching and push it forward to other people who come on the scene. That's the way to keep it going.
The goal, that's the goal. That's, if it's done right, then the goal of some of the companies that we've trained and so forth, where we've gone into the large trainings, the goal is for those employees who are in management team to take it back to their retail level shops or stores, if you will, and train their management team, people who are out on the floor, for example, interacting with customers. Then from there to train cashiers, salespeople, stocking people, things like that. You hope that'll happen. Unfortunately, all too often it gets left behind because there are often so many other things to do. And there are so many other things that are asked of these employees, setting up a 1 or 2 or 3 hour training session, making sure you do it with, you know, onboarding for new employees, things like that. That's really hard to set up and it's hard to do on a local level. So you hope at least that your impact is there for, as I said, you know, the management team to carry on for other people.
And often training by itself doesn't accomplish very much, even if the training is fabulous, because then the next step, of course, is of incorporating what you've taught into the culture and making sure that the culture involved supports that kind of stuff. And often it doesn't.
You're absolutely right, Peter. If, you know, I can train until I'm blue in the face and people can leave the training room and says, thank you. Know, it's thank you. This is a great skill. I learned something. I'm aware. I have a greater knowledge base. But, you know, when you get out of that room, if that company or that medical facility, for example, isn't able to implement or can't make substantive changes, and sometimes those changes are not just training, but they have to be physical plant changes to the way racks are or the way desks are, or, you know, realizing that they're going to upgrade a facility and what's involved in the transformation when you start doing new construction or reconstruction. There are so many factors that can get in the way of all of this and how it follows down once you leave that training room.
Before we go into the whole accommodations piece, I just want to comment on your story about how you working with your kid with a disability sort of impacted the way you think about advocacy. Because the same thing is true for me. When I moved to Missouri to get married for the first time, my ex-wife had 3 kids with psychiatric disabilities, and working with the school system was a real challenge to sort of make sure they had the supports they need and making sure that the kids were taking advantage of those supports, you know, sort of worked both ways. But it was an interesting experience and something I will never ever forget.
You know what? It's no pun intended. It's eye opening. It's a lot of work. I learned a lot about the process. I learned a lot about what does work, what doesn't work. I learned how the system in many ways is stacked against the individuals, especially then. And in some ways, even now, because of our economic times, it's just as stacked as it was then. You know, you would think if you go way back to 1990, when the Americans with Disabilities Act was first signed by first President Bush, you would think that in, you know, almost 35 years, things would have drastically changed. And we see some of those changes perhaps publicly on sidewalks with you know, braille pads, things like that, you know, intersections that have a sound device at the light, things like that.
Wheelchair ramps.
We restrooms, things. But what we don't see is once you get into other areas where there needs to be a significant investment on a continuous basis, you don't see those investments of time and you don't see those investments of dollars. So there are investments now when it's required, but there aren't too many investments of dollars or time if it's not required. So I wish I could say we've come a long way. We have a better understanding, but we have an awfully long way to go.
I have one more quick question and then we can either go back to Peter or start out with the accommodations piece. Now, briefly, Jonathan, I think I may have introduced you to a concept called universal design in public housing. I have articles about that topic. I may have sent you one or two. If you recall,
Bob, and you didn't actually introduce it to me. Universal design for a housing concept has been something that's been there for a long period of time. Unfortunately, universal design concepts, first of all, are kind of alluding to what I just said. They're very expensive to implement. They potentially leave units uninhabited or unrented or unsold. Because very often you can develop those units, you can have those units, but if you don't have the bodies to put in them because you can't get there from here, or because transportation doesn't align with that, or because a person's income or medical need doesn't align with that, the problem is that most developers will not build something in advance that requires universal design. What they will do is they will build based on a universal design concept if they're building something and there are tenants or individuals who are going to be purchasing who meet the need at that point.
But if the universal design concept is for anyone, disabled or otherwise, why is it so difficult to find?
Because it's too expensive. It's prohibitively expensive. That's the simple answer.
I'm not as familiar with universal designing in housing. I am more familiar with it when it comes to the workplace, and we'll probably come back to it. And then if you contrast with inclusive design and the two, the way I understand it, sort of meld quite nicely. Let's talk about a reasonable accommodations. And let's start with asking the obvious question. What is an accommodation?
So a reasonable accommodation there's different kinds of reasonable accommodation. There's reasonable accommodation for employment. There's reasonable accommodation for access. And then there's reasonable accommodation for, if you will, when I say employment, for a person who's receiving Social Security disability income, for example, or SSI income, and what a person would need to be able to receive from the government's perspective, federal assistance through SSI or SSDI, because reasonable accommodation can be calculated into their benefit level as well. So when you look at employment, I think one of the things that you want to think about is that reasonable accommodation doesn't mean that simply because I'm blind, if I'm capable of doing the job, I should be given the job. What reasonable accommodation really means is because of the accommodation the person may need, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples in a minute, because of the accommodation the person may need, isn't it reasonable to assume that the employer can provide that accommodation or make that accommodation for the employee to be able to do up to 100% of the required requirements of the job at all times, even if they need assistance or they can have assistance. Now, having said that, if the accommodation is going to cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000, or there's a significant annual cost to upgrading resources or technology, that person may be able to do 100% of the job. But if the cost of maintaining what they can do for the job is prohibitive, then from the employer's perspective and often from the court's perspective, it's not reasonable. If the individual can't do 100% of the job, the employer has no legal obligation to hire that person or to commit to that person. Then you get into the side of it, and this is, again, that crosses that line separately, which is disclosure. If the person has disability, what's the responsibility of the individual to disclose before, during, or after onboarding for the expectation that the employer is going to meet that expected reasonable accommodation? And that's a slippery slope, because a lot of people are afraid if they're pre-qualified for something, they don't want to tell the employer I have A, B, or C disability, especially if it's not an obvious disability. They often don't want to say it because they're afraid they'll be excluded from the job. And unfortunately, with the bots that do ferreting out of resumes these days, that's often true. If the employee does self-disclose and doesn't get the job, I will tell you it's very rare the employer is going to say outwardly, openly, or in writing, we didn't hire you because of your disability and because of A, B, C, or D. So, you know, that there are so many parts of that, but I think the most reasonable thing to think about first is, can I do 100% of the job? What's required for me to do the job? What are the modifications that the employer or a Commonwealth or agency would need to make to help the employer meet my needs for 100% of the ability to do the job? Is it prohibitive in terms of cost or access, or is it not? And give you two different examples just to think about. I am totally blind, as I said. I have access to all the technology in the world, and I think I'm pretty good at it. But if I go to a company and they want me to do analytics and spreadsheets all the time, if it's going to take me 50% or 60 or 70% more time to do the analytics because I'm trying to listen to spreadsheets all the time, I'm doing 100% of the job, but I'm not doing it at the level that's expected to me 100% of the time. I'm only able to perform at a 50% level in terms of expectation, but yet I expect to receive 100% of the salary. If I can do 100% of the job on my own, or 80% of the job, or 90% of the job, and that's okay with the employer, and they don't mind that it takes me longer, that's a decision the employer is making, and it's not unreasonable as a reasonable accommodation. On the other hand, let's assume a case that I had not too long ago, for example. We have a situation where this person is a first responder. This person has a comfort dog, if you will, okay? Not a guide dog, but a comfort dog because of a trauma that they witnessed and were involved in a couple of years ago. This person switched from one agency to another agency, and they wanted the comfort dog to come with them. The agency determined that that's not a reasonable accommodation. Why? Because that comfort dog is often going to have to be unattended when that person has to go out on a call. A call could be 2 hours, it could be 6 hours, it could be 12 hours. Then the thought was, well, what if we let this person go home if they're traumatized, and then they can be with their dog when they go home? Well, if you do that, then you're giving that person an opportunity to go home and leave the job that you're not affording other employees. So something like that, frankly, is not a reasonable accommodation. It sounds like it should be, but it's not. So I don't know if that answers your question, Peter.
I want to get a little more into the weeds about this because I think it's really important. So let's first focus on the word accommodation. What is an accommodation?
The accommodation is generally, and I'm going to keep it pretty simple without going into all the law behind it, but the accommodation is generally providing a resource of technology or equipment or even access to a person so that that person is able to perform the job if we're talking about employment. Now, again, that's employment. If we're talking about accommodation to get into a building, that's a whole different situation.
Right. And one of the things I find really sort of interesting about the whole accommodations piece, and we were talking about universal design. When I got my first major job out of graduate school, it was 1992, which was 2 years after the ADA was passed. And my boss, who was not disabled, I would regularly come into her office at like 9 o'clock in the morning and, you know, ask her a bunch of questions. And so one morning she came into my office and says, Peter, I have an accommodation to ask of you. And I said, yeah, what's that? She said, well, I'm not really a morning person. If you could wait, hold off and ask me questions until 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm in a much better place. I'm more awake. I've drunk my coffee. I'm in a better place to be able to work with you. Can you, you know, will you do that? And of course she was my boss. And of course I said, yes. But the interesting thing was it totally changed our relationship because I chose to accommodate her sort of, I'm not a morning person disability, as it were. Now a morning disability is morning person is not a disability. But the reason I sort of think about this as universal design is because we all accommodate to each other all the time. It's a common practice, workplace, not workplace, any relationship we're accommodating. So what we're doing when it comes to disability, the accommodations are a little more specific. But often when I've talked to employers, I talk about this, that we all accommodate each other on a regular basis, or we should. And so I'm just sort of curious to know what your thoughts about that are.
Well, my thoughts on that would be what you did was a logical, I would say it was a logical path for you to take the understanding side of it and your employer to ask you to be understanding. However, having said that, let's assume for a minute, potentially, that one of you was quote unquote self-identified through the employer's company or organization as a person who was autistic or as a person who has OCD or something of that nature. Then asking for if your employer was already self-identified, for example, as having OCD, then potentially, and the employer doesn't have to tell you that, by the way, but then the employer asked you to accommodate them by, you know, simply, can you hold off your questions of anything you need for support until 11 a.m.? Because perhaps with OCD, the employer needs to be able to totally focus on other things earlier in that 2 hour period. The employer doesn't have to tell you that. But if you put your back up and said no, then oddly enough, you could be the one who could potentially found as not being willing to, if you will, play ball as opposed to that person. Because if that person has a self-identified disability, then their ask of you may not have been considered unreasonable, even if you felt you couldn't accommodate it.
Sure. That makes good sense. But often, often, you know, we do this accommodation piece without thinking, and adding the disability component makes it more important, perhaps, that we do these things. But I still think, you know, trying our best to accommodate to people's unique challenges is, you know, it's mostly often common sense 90% of the time.
Yeah. And again, just to briefly say, I don't disagree with you. You have to keep in mind is that when a person needs to self-accommodate or self-disclose, the only person they need to disclose it to really technically is HR. If the organization is large enough to have HR. If it's a small office space, for example, and there's only 4, 5, 6, 10 people, then they would have to disclose it to the owner or the office manager. It does not have to be disclosed to anyone else. And in fact, if you have an immediate supervisor, it doesn't even have to be disclosed to the immediate supervisor if you've disclosed it to HR. It's your decision with HR whether or not you want it to disclose to an immediate supervisor. If the supervisor is somebody who talks and talks and talks to everybody and you're concerned, well, you might want to say, I don't want Bob to know because I know he talks to everybody and he has a big mouth. Sorry, Bob. But, you know, there's decisions that have to be made because of HIPAA protection here as well. So I wish I could say there's a one size fits all, but there's not.
No, Jonathan, just to be clear about accommodations in general. Now, how much of a percentage of these accommodations do you suppose employers have to assume financially? I know that in my lifetime, the jobs that I've had where I was given accommodations, my boss never had to pay for those accommodations.
Well, first of all, you live in a state where accommodations are provided quite easily by the state when they're needed or other organizations. There are a lot of states that people live in where trying to get those resources from their state or agencies affiliated with the state are almost impossible. And that, unfortunately, is the majority of states around the country. So that's one side of it. Another side of it is if you're going to go to work for a small organization and your accommodation is going to cost $10,000, so they have to upgrade technology or bring in all new technology for you, then that $10,000 for that small organization is a lot of money. That might represent 5 or 10% of their profit for the year. But if you're a large corporation and it represents pennies on the dollar, I think that speaks for itself. And then you get into, you know, what's their policy versus their procedure versus their expectation.
And this gets into the reasonable component, right? We talked about what an accommodation is, but then we get to the whole concept of what makes it reasonable.
Exactly. So
go ahead.
Let me just for a minute, Peter, give you something that I told you that reasonable can also cross the line, for example, of Social Security. So let me just take that separately for a second just to touch on it. And I'm going to give you a thumbnail example. A person is making $40,000 a year. That's their gross salary before taxes are taken out. yet the person can only receive, in the case of blindness, just over, you know, you can get just over $2,000 a month of total deductions as a blind person in order to continue to receive your benefit. So that's roughly $24,000 a year, but your gross salary is $40,000. So you're in danger of losing quite a bit of your benefit. However, if as a totally blind person, you have a guide dog and that costs you between food, et cetera, $200 a month, and you have transportation, Uber, $600 a month, and you have reader assistance or technology assistance, $600 a month. All of these things can be taken off that $40,000, and this is not available to the disability community at large. This is a blindness exemption, for example, that's much higher than people who have other disability, but there are formulas for the others. My point here is you can be a person who is blind, making $40,000 gross, and have enough of a deduction in terms of your blindness benefits through Social Security Administration. You need assistance 20% of the time to do your job. That means talking to your boss, talking to other managers, asking people to read things for you or translate them because your screen reader won't do it. That's $8,000 right there. All of these things come off that $40,000 top. So theoretically, you could take your actual work-related expenses down to $20,000. What did I say that the cap was? A little over $24,000. You're still going to keep all of your benefits. So that's just a separate example of how it can work for you. And in some cases, it can also work against you.
So can we talk about if my legal information is, I'm still remembering it properly. There's a difference between what makes it reasonable in the workplace and in a medical facility that you're there as a patient or something else. There's sort of the readily achievable versus undue hardship component. Can you sort of talk about the difference?
So I think there's a difference between the physical space and what the requirements are to make that physical space, if that's what you're getting at. Is that what you're asking?
Well, my understanding is that undue hardship is a harder thing to surmount as an employer. So if an employer says, I can't do this accommodation, the undue hardship is, you know, you have to prove a little more that you can't provide the accommodation. Whereas the other one, it's much easier to overcome as you're saying, as a medical facility. You know, as if the person is a disabled customer and wanting a certain accommodation, it's easier to say no if for a customer, but compared to an employee, that's what I'm trying to say.
So I think there are a couple of things. You have Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act is how the public sector has to accommodate a person with a disability. Public sector might be your town hall, city hall, public hospitals, public universities, things of that nature. Then you have Title III, which is the public-private partnership. Title III is really what dictates a lot of what we do and where we go and what's accommodable and not. Public-private partnership are facilities that are privately owned but open to the public. And under Title III, you have a whole myriad of things, from medical facilities to department stores to restaurants. So your local enforcement officer or your building code person, for example, has to look at Title III. On one level, does it meet a local or state building code? But separately, what are their compliance requirements they have to meet above and beyond that, because they have to meet the needs of accommodation? There are formulas that have to be used to determine, especially when you look at the public-private sector, there are formulas that have to be used to determine whether or not the facility, if it's a new facility, very simply, they have a 100% requirement to meet their own state code and federal requirements. Now, in some states, the federal requirements are stronger. And in other states like Massachusetts, the state requirements are actually stronger than the federal requirements. And that's because of when legislation was adopted and changed. You have 2010 federal regulation, for example. Mass adopted and changed it and made it stronger in 2012. Other states have never adopted other changes. Other states have made it stronger. But what happens is I'll give you an example. If you have new construction, without question, it has to be 100% accessible. if you have older construction, and unfortunately this does even apply to a lot of medical facilities, if they want to reconstruct that facility, in order for them to have to make it fully compliant, they have to show that the cost of reconstruction is more than 30% of the assessed value. So if you have a building that's the assessment value, which means when I say assessed value, I mean the building is assessed for the purposes of taxes, paying public taxes, as we all do, or you know, facilities do. So it's $1 million assessment. The accommodations would have to exceed, the renovations rather would have to exceed $300,000 in order for them to have to make that building fully compliant. So if they're going to do renovations on hallways or stairwells or something, and those renovations come to $110,000, unfortunately, that also doesn't mean that they have to then make all their restrooms accessible and larger with 36-inch wide doors and guard, and you know, the bars at 30 to 32 inches, things like that, and the sinks at 30 inches with access for a wheelchair to get under it. They don't have to do that if they keep their threshold under that 30% in many cases. And very often, especially in older construction, even in medical facilities, you'll see that they don't necessarily do the higher level of construction all at one time because they don't have those dollars and they don't want to be forced to have to make 100% of the accommodations to the entire facility. So they'll start by making the accommodations perhaps to the public areas, the doorways to the building to make sure that they're at 36 inches wide or that there's electric doors, things like that. They may do it on certain restrooms, but they may only do it on the public restrooms. They may not do it on the employee restrooms because the public doesn't have access. So, you know, there are a lot of different things to think about when you're really thinking about all this stuff.
And I just want to make sure I have this right. Faith communities, churches, synagogues, temples, mosques, they are exempt from all this stuff, right?
Yes, they are. To a point, they are, yes.
I've been to a lot of churches that are not accessible, but it's very difficult for some people to get in.
However, it's funny you say that, Peter, because I'll give you an example of something. You're right. They are exempt from this in most cases. However, oddly enough, in my town, we just recently purchased an old church that we're renovating to make our new public library. We're trying to keep the old character of the building and keep the historical component of the building, but because the building is now going to be changing from private use to public use, we have to put in ramps. We have to have our library shelving 36 inches wide as well to accommodate wheelchairs and larger radius for the turns. We have to have a ramp inside that goes up to another room area. We have to have two fully accessible restrooms, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an example of a building that was at one time not required to meet today's standard, but because of what we're doing to make it a public building and combination of that over 30% value, we have to make it fully accessible.
And what I find sort of interesting about this is the church that I go to has a couple of things that make it difficult for my wife to go up and down stairs safely. And, you know, we were talking about this and I said, you know, Carrie, you can't insist on this, you know, legally it's, you know, she knew that. So we had to go to the, you know, the church elders and said, hey, we got a problem. Yeah, she did. And they were they understood, and they're going to try and take care of it as funds allow. But, you know, it's a different world. If that church were something else, you know, they would have to make this correction, I think, you know, cause it's a relatively simple fix that's involved, but they're not required to do it legally.
We are about ready to bring in our participants. I just wanted to remind everybody that this is In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco and he's Peter Altschul. Our guest is Jonathan Gale. He is a disability policy specialist and advocate. And before we welcome participants, let me just acknowledge Trish, our host, and thank her very much for helping us out today. I'm not sure who's streaming us, but I know we are being streamed on ACB Media 5. Let me give up my email address in case people need to send us questions or comments or would like to do so about our show and other shows that we've done. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's all one word. I also want to say hi to Susan Jones, who listens faithfully. Thank you for doing so. So, Trish, do we have any hands raised at this time? Dennis from Fall River, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dennis.
Jonathan, I just need a clarification, because I think in Massachusetts, churches and houses of worship are not exempt from the architectural access regulations. Is that correct?
Yes and no. It depends on when they've last done renovations. So there are certain situations where they can be exempt, or they can get a variance from the Massachusetts Architectural Access Board.
And this just reminds me that, you know, I've been talking primarily about federal law, but each state's different, as you said, Jonathan.
That's correct.
And a
simple example would be, you know, if you have a church, Dennis, that, you know, the current regulation calls for it to have two egresses because there's at least two exits under MGL 521 CMR, for example. So that's a requirement. But if they can't do it because it's an historical building, then they're going to apply to the Massachusetts Architectural Access Board for a variance. And then it's determine whether or not they should get that variance. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you is theoretically you are correct, but not one answer applies to all.
Okay.
Anything else, Dennis?
All right. Well, thanks for your contribution. All right, Trish, who is next?
Next we have Tony.
All right, Tony.
The Yankees fan.
The Yankee fan from New York. Yes.
Yes, sir. Jonathan, I didn't want the session to go by without you talking a little about disclosure of disability in, I guess, employment situations, because we didn't get to that. So I just thought I'd ask you if you could talk a little about your thinking on that topic.
Sure. You know, for disclosure, there's not a one size. Again, I wish I could say there's a one size that fits all, Tony, but there's not. And I think those of us who have an obvious disability, if, you know, I'm totally blind, I need technology, I use a white cane. You know, some folks use a guide dog, for example. It's obvious that I have a disability. So to me, at least, regardless of what the position requires for reasonable accommodation, from the disclosure side of it, it's important for me, for people with my type of disability, to disclose that they have that disability. I think the employer needs to know, and the employer would feel very, very slighted, if you will, or misled if I didn't tell them that, at least by the time I got my first interview. Having said that, there are a lot of types of disability where people are afraid to tell an employer. For example, somebody who has epilepsy. Maybe they haven't had a seizure in years. So as far as they're concerned, they live with a disability. Live diagnosis of disability, but they quote unquote don't have a disability. They're managing it through medication, perhaps. They don't want to disclose. And then during employment, that person has an episode. They could be putting their job in jeopardy because they haven't disclosed to the employer that they have this disability that could have an effect on them. Suppose that employee later had to put in for a short-term disability, but they hadn't disclosed that the short-term disability, they're getting it granted, perhaps they're signed off by a doctor because of their epilepsy, but they never disclosed it to the employer and it was a pre-existing condition. That creates problems. In most cases, that short-term disability is probably going to be denied as an example. And I say that because, you know, this is something that people struggle with all the time. Do I want my employer to know? Do I not want them? Very often what will happen is a person will get into a job, especially if it's a larger company or organization. They'll work there. They'll get beyond their 60 or 90 day period of having to prove yourself. And then they'll disclose because they feel safer. They feel more comfortable. Is that right or wrong? I don't think that's for me to determine. I think that's for the individual to determine. You know, again, there are a lot of reasons why people do that, but I wish there was a one size fits all, and there's no one regulation that automatically qualifies or disqualifies a person from having to do it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in this business a long time, so I wanted you to explain it mostly to everybody else. Well, the one thing, though, it crosses back to the other conversation. If you want an accommodation from your employer, you have to disclose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can't expect there are some people, for example, the accommodation can be as simple as, you're hiring me, but I've had a, you know, I wear a back brace.
So I need a chair that can accommodate me and my back brace. Or I need to be moved to an area where there's a lot of light coming in the room. You know, I'm on the spectrum. I'm on the higher end of the Asperger spectrum, for example. So perhaps I need an area where it's quiet or it feels softer to work in. Well, if I'm able to perform the job at 100% of my ability and I know it, and that's the kind of accommodation I need ahead of time, that's something I might want to ask for because I feel that I can perform the job at 100% of the ability without having to prove myself to the employer. And I'm hoping that if the employer wants me and they know that I'm on the spectrum, for example, or they know that I have a back problem and I need a brace, that's an accommodation that doesn't necessarily require them to have an expensive dollars, but it's more an expensive resource and location.
And if you can get far enough into the process where your employer has decided you are really, truly qualified for the job, you have much more safety and leverage if you need it when you do disclose your disability, because they've already made a determination you are otherwise qualified, which is the wording in the ADA.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes people, they wait until they get deeper into the process to see if that employer really does deem them otherwise qualified, so that it's a little bit less risky then, because they have already in effect been determined to be qualified for the job. So it's not a game, but
no,
they kind of do, but they kind of have to play the game, even though it's really not a game.
You have, unfortunately, too many people have to play the game, Tony. And I think what happens, and you would probably agree with this, is that unfortunately, too many people make the assumption, oh, I have a disability. They can't fire me. They can't this. They can't that. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah.
And unless you know it, and unless you understand it and work with it, you know, you'll go out and tell your friends, yeah, if I don't do such and such, or I don't have to worry about it. I'll keep my job. That's not the truth at all. You still have to perform. You still have to prove to the employer what you're capable of doing.
That's common sense.
You can do it at 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this comes back, Tony, the whole issue of when to disclose, you know, and that really to me is the game, right? Do you disclose to be, you know, as part of your resume that you're disabled, your cover letter? Do you disclose when you're scheduling the interview? Do you disclose during the interview? Do you disclose after you're hired? All those kinds of questions. You know, it's one thing to disclose, but the real important question is when and how.
I will say, Peter, I think that one of the problems with disclosing early these days is that years ago, when many of us on this call were much younger, you did your resumes individually. You mailed them in or you emailed it to somebody individually. Maybe you even spoke to the person who's going to be the interviewer on the phone prior to sending that in. Nowadays, everything is done online. Almost everything is done online. And very often resumes are sorted by bots, and they're looking at keywords in those bots to determine what resumes are going to get through and what aren't. And because of that, if we put certain keywords that we don't know an employer is looking at out of thousands of words potentially in that word list in our resume, it's never going to get beyond the bot, and we're never going to get a phone call or an extension or anything. So, you know, the devil's in what we do these days without even knowing who anything's going to, because it's never going to get there. And I think that has a lot to do with people not wanting to disclose anymore, you know, in their resume or in that first phone call they get or make to an office to see, who do I send my resume to? That doesn't exist anymore unless it's a small business.
So that leads me to a basic question, Jonathan. When is it appropriate to disclose your disability literally on a resume?
I think if you have a disability, this is my personal opinion, and this is what I advise people. If you have a disability that is automatically going to require some kind of accommodation, you should disclose it on your resume, but as an afterthought. So if you have the resume at the bottom of the resume, please be advised, for example, please be advised that, you know, that I am visually, I wouldn't say totally blind. I would say that I am visually impaired, that I use a screen reader. However, I am fully capable of performing my position at 100% of expectation, period. That's it. I'm not going to talk in there about what I need. I'm not going to talk about it or what they have and what they can offer me, because I don't know. But I am going to say I'm visually impaired. I use Screen Reader and I can inform, but I believe I can perform this position at 100% of expectation in accordance with the job description as described.
There are two other times when I have disclosed my visual impairment before the interview. I usually wait to the interview to disclose. Although, as you said, Jonathan, the situation's changed in the past 5 years or so. The first is if the job is for a disability organization, right? Then it might really help my case to talk about that I have a disability and put it on the resume or my cover letter. And the other time is if I need some help going through the job application. You know, if the application online is not accessible, Then I have to disclose if I want to apply for the job to get a reasonable accommodation to get the job, you know, to get the application done.
And Peter, you're right. And that gets into a whole nother side of it, which is if the job application itself isn't fully accessible and employers, because things change all the time, it is hard to always keep everything accessible on any employer's website. Having said that, if it's not fully accessible, what does that mean that the employer is or isn't going to try and do for you? And you don't even know half the time. They may be the greatest employer in the world and they're going to apologize until the cows come home that it's not accessible for you there. But once you're there, they'll do everything they can to make everything accessible for you. I think the other thing to keep in mind, unfortunately, and this is a segue a little bit, I guess, too, is that very often people with disability end up working, I hate to sound like this, for disability organizations, sometimes because they think that's the only job they can get or the only place they can get hired. And that's when I say to those folks, you know, keep sending out your resume, keep calling places, keep using your contacts, because you don't know, as much as a disability organization may want you, you have a skill set that can be just as utilized just as well in another sector of the job market. So don't give up and don't assume that. The other thing I think that happens very often is that employers are very quick to lowball, and I hate to use that term, employees with disability when it comes to salary discussion, because the employer doesn't necessarily consider the employee as having the same qualification or skill set. They'll hire them based on the resume, based on the college that they've had or based on prior experience, whatever it is. But then when it actually comes down to discussing the dollars, the employer will often place a lesser value on that person with the disability as they will the person who doesn't have a quote disability unquote, but has the exact same qualifications.
Isn't there a wage law though, despite that?
What do you mean by a wage law?
Isn't an employer required to pay anybody, disabled or otherwise, at least a certain amount of money, like a minimum wage or above?
Every employer is required to pay at least minimum wage, Bob, but every employer sets their salary for a job. And what you'll see is most jobs, for example, you know, salary ranges from $33,000 to $52,000. So the employer is determining from that 33 to 52, based on you or me, which one of us they're going to offer 52 for and which one of us they're going to offer 33 or somewhere in the middle. They don't have to tell me what they're offering you and vice versa.
Right. It's all about minimum wage. So the question is, you know, who are they going to offer
I might make $20 an hour while my colleague might make 40.
Absolutely. And if the employer thinks that they might have to pay for other accommodations for you, they may offer you a lower figure because they're trying to calculate in the accommodation and they're not going to tell you that. I've seen that happen many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Tony. Trish, do we have any hands raised at this time?
Oh, yes, we do.
Go right ahead.
One in Clubhouse as well. So let's go ahead and get the
all right. One. Next up, we have Greg Onesnyder in Clubhouse.
Ah, Greg.
Go ahead, Greg.
Hi, Peter and guests. Thank you very much for being here. So my question is a little bit different. I'm working part-time as a greeter right now. But I'd like to be more gainfully employed with the current company that I'm at. And I feel like there's some skill sets that I could do in addition to my greeting or while I'm doing my greeting that I'm not being allowed to do. How do I share what I'm able to do with my boss? Because right now he just has me, you know, in a position as greeter, but how do I share that and say, hey, these are things, even though I can't see, these are things that I think that I, you know, could do. And these are some things with some accommodations. For instance, you know, if the cash register had something on it that could, you know, read to me by voice, which I believe the technology is out there, you know, I could help out with that, or I could, and possibly get myself some more hours working that way. So I don't know if you had any comments on that.
Sure. Let me give you an example of something there too, because that's a fair question. And I think what you have to think about is whether or not your skill set or the skills that you want to learn are going to be skills that can be used in another position where you're employed. So let's just take what you said, operating a cash register. If the cash register, and hear me out before so I can explain this, I'll try to explain it quickly. If the cash register requires that there's a high volume of customers and the cashier is expected to do so many either dollars per hour through the cash register or so many customers an hour through the cash register, and there's an expectation of that, and that's sort of almost, that's a part of a requirement of the position that could make it difficult for you. However, if you can show that, for example, with your telephone, you can use a device, you can use the Google AI glasses, for example, to read or help you read prices on something, or when they don't scan, or if there's a scanner for it and you have an optic device to do it so you can hear it in your ear with a Bluetooth device or something, and then you can key those things into the register. You might be able to make the case by showing your employer, these are ways I can do certain parts of this. Now, then there's other things. What happens if a person puts a credit card in? How do you hear that? What are you going to do if the credit card doesn't work? What if you have to look at a picture ID to validate who somebody is? These are all the little parts that you have to think about in order to be able to do that position. But I think if you can do that and you can come up with reasonable solutions, I would also say, I don't know what state you live in, but depending upon the state you live in.
I'm in Wisconsin. Yeah. Okay.
If Wisconsin has an organization through their state's commission for the blind or other rehab organization that can provide you some of those tools, I would suggest trying to get some of those tools that I just mentioned, for example, and using them first to see how they work for you individually. Instead of just saying, I think I can do it. If you're going to go to your employer and you have a reasonable relationship with your employer, and you want to make the case, you want to be able to say to the employer, listen, I know you're not thinking I can do this, but let me show you what I can do. Teach yourself first. Learn how to use these things first and think of all the possibilities that could come up so you have answers for them.
One other thing I would add to that, and I'm curious to know what you think, is know what the employer is struggling with, you know, as it impacts your job. So if you know the employer is struggling with, I don't know, customer service issues of some kind, and you have good customer service skills, then, you know, it's just good attitude to go to your employer and say, hey, you know, I think I can help you in this area. I have good customer service skills. I can do this part of the job through talking about various accommodations that you know work. You're more likely to get heard. Part of the problem about all this is that in my experience, many of the hiring managers, the bosses, the frontline middle manager are just totally stressed out and whacked out. And the only way that you can get your message heard is by helping them solve a problem that they're having. If you can figure that out, you have a much better shot of being heard.
And I would agree with Peter on that entirely, frankly. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of those frontline people who come in, they're a dime a dozen. You know, they're a supervisor one day and 3 months there's another one, and 3 months there's another one. And then they're out the door because they find something better or they're going back to college or something like that. But for example, keeping in mind what Peter said, if you're a greeter and people know your face and you get along with people, maybe there's a customer service desk that you can learn to train yourself at using the tools that I mentioned, which might not have to be so fast paced, but yet would inevitably allow you to simply use some of the skill set you've already shown your boss that you have.
We have about 2 minutes, folks, so I just want to move right along. If there's any final hand raised, we can take that call now. Greg, thank you so much, and good luck to you, too.
All right. We have three hands, which we obviously are not going to get to. So the next one we have is area code 518-517. Please unmute.
That's Teresa, I believe. Teresa, you've got about 1 minute.
Actually, it's Mary Beth.
I'm sorry, Mary Beth. My apologies.
No problem, Bob. Hey. Thank you so much for sharing, Jonathan. I really enjoyed your presentation. I just wondered if you could briefly comment on over-accommodation. you know, with the fact that if you come in there and you have a disability, that all our people with disabilities, this is what we do for them. And you, if you don't like it, especially healthcare facilities are like this, you're stuck with the accommodation, or they think you should be. Thank you.
So are you, let me ask you, are you asking for that as an employee or as a person who's being accommodated?
I'm just asking in general, because I think that sometimes, especially if, especially in healthcare or especially.
Let me cut you off because I know we have a very short amount of time. I think part of our responsibility as people with disabilities is to educate the public or the employer or the facility for what they don't know. So, for example, if I go into a place and somebody is over the top, if you will, they want to immediately grab my arm. They want to touch my hand and hold me and pull me to things and so forth. I will say very simply, you know what? It's much easier for me if I just take the back of your elbow. It mirrors your hip. If you jump up and down, I'm going to jump up and down.
Sighted guy.
Mind you. If you do things like that, that just educate the employer and or the office manager or the medical facility and stop them for a second and say, I appreciate everything you're doing. But let me tell you what works for me. And I think it's okay. They appreciate, they would rather do that because for them to accommodate you very often, especially if they're doing it physically or on a regular basis, it's awkward.
Our time is up, unfortunately. Teresa, thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody. It's been a fast show. Jonathan, we'd love to have you back. You have a lot to contribute. And so I want to thank everybody for a great show today. There's a lot to learn about, disability policy and accommodations and disclosure and other related topics. Take care, everybody. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. We'll talk next week on In Perspective. Take care, everybody.